I'm Bob Boylan with All Songs Considered. Imagine being a singer, and in this case, a singer of traditional British folk songs, murder ballads, songs of love and hate, revenge, redemption, and tragedy. And as the singer of these songs, you get pretty well known in the circles of folk music in the 60s. Now imagine a broken heart robs you of your ability to sing, and for 38 years, your voice, once beautiful, is now silent. This is the story of the great Shirley Collins. But this tragic tale has a happy epilogue because Shirley Collins is finally singing again, and she has a new record, and she's our guest today on All Songs Considered. I listened to Shirley Collins' music as a teen in the heyday of British folk music. I owned records by the Albion Band, the band she put together with her then lover and husband, Ashley Hutchings. Her songs were a huge influence on American singers as well. And one of those singers, so many years later, was Colin Molloy. And if you listen to The Decemberists, you know how much Colin loves a good tale and a good murder ballad. In fact, Colin Molloy released an EP of Shirley Collins' songs about 10 years ago. And so on this edition of All Songs Considered, Collins and Colin, a conversation with Shirley Collins and Colin Molloy. Shirley Collins is in England at the University of Sussex, Colin Molloy in Portland, Oregon, and I'm here in Washington, D.C. And I begin the conversation by playing this song from the new Shirley Collins album called Lodestar, and the song Cruel Lincoln.
Said the Lord to his lady, I am now going out. Be aware of cruel Lincoln, who lives by the gate. What care I for Lincoln, or any of his kin? My doors are all bolted, and the windows are as soon as her lord had got out of sight, cruel Lincoln crept in the middle of the night. Got and pinched my sweet baby, which caused it to cry, while the nurse sat singing, oh, hush a lullaby. Oh, nurse, cried the lady, how sound you do sleep, whilst my little baby most bitterly do weep. Oh, lady, dear lady, come and take it on your lap, for I cannot quiet it with miracle. The lady came down, not thinking any harm. Cruel Lincoln stood awaiting for to catch her in his arms. Oh, Lincoln, cruel
Shirley Collins, and I'm sure Colin Molloy will think this too. It's so great to hear your voice again. This song is called Cruel Lincoln, and what's about to happen in this tale? Because it ain't pretty.
It's a pretty bloody ballad, isn't it? But in a way, you can justify Cruel Lincoln's actions because he's a mason and he's built a manor house for the local lord and he hasn't been paid and he's out for revenge.
It's interesting that these songs, you so rarely get the full backstory. I think I spent a couple listens to this song and that's interesting. For once, I wondered, how did he get in if the doors were bolted and the windows were pinned?
Not securely enough.
Well, he knew the secrets?
Probably right. This particular version of the ballad, which was collected in Sussex in the mid-1950s, came from a gamekeeper called Ben Butcher. And he didn't have the verse that explains the story, which is why, you know, I've had to just put that as a note in the song. But some versions do start with verses such as, Lincoln was as fine a mason as ever was on land. No, as ever the sun shone on, he built the Lord a castle, but paid payment got he none. So some of the songs do explain it from the start, but Ben Butcher's version just started off with the Lord going out. And in many ways, I like to keep it the way somebody specific, you know, countryman sang it in the past, because it fascinates me, just fascinates me. And yeah. I like to keep some mysteries in songs as well, you know.
Well, the explanation kind of justifies the action, but maybe not completely. It seems a little excessive.
There's blood in the kitchen.
Not being paid.
There was blood in the kitchen, blood in the hall, blood in the parlor.
Where the lady did fall, yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, some people have made a bit of a joke about, well, not a joke exactly, but they've smiled as they remark, you know, what's the body count on this album? Well, I say, you know, it's probably not as high as any violent film you're going to see tomorrow or any game you're going to play on your laptop, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I get that question a lot, actually. There's a pretty high body count on December's records, but right. I was glad to hear this record and get me off the hook a little bit.
What is the fascination for you both? You both are actually, at least I think, gentle spirits.
Yes, I am. Sorry, Colin, what for you? What's the...
Well, I don't know. I mean, for listening to this record, you know, and to have steeped myself in some of Shirley's peers and the people who came after her, I often wonder where that fascination comes from me. Like, I don't know that I have an answer. But listening to these songs, it becomes clear. I think there is something in these songs, in old folk songs, that appealed to me. There's something about the drama and the grimness and what people were up against, particularly at the time when these songs were written. The stakes were just so much higher.
Yep, that's absolutely right. I mean, I'm a down-to-earth and very cheerful person, but, you know, I just love these songs. They hold me spellbound, and not only for listening to them once, you know, but to hearing them all the time. I just am fascinated by them. And in England, there's this sort of melancholy that pervades so many of the songs as well, in the tradition, that is. We think of England sometimes as merry England, you know, or silver jewels set in a silver sea from Shakespeare. But there was a dark side to England as well, as I'm afraid there still is. And these songs just reflect honestly, you know, what is going on all the time. You can't dismiss them, really, and nor do I want to.
I love the way you set it against, I don't know if this was how this was done, but it opens, the album opens with these beautiful birds are chirping, and it's quite a sweet, lovely setting. I imagine I'm sitting outside and my grass is under my feet.
Well, we were recording it in my cottage in Lewes, and at the back of my garden is a huge bank with masses of trees, and it's filled with birds in the summer. And it was a very hot day when we recorded this particular song, and we had all the windows open, the kitchen windows and the back door, and we recorded the song almost unaware that this bird song was being recorded at the same time. And when we listened to the playback, we all said, got to keep it in, you know, it's such a sort of antidote, a normalcy against the horror of the story.
Yeah, I'd wondered if the record had been recorded outside. I know there's people who have tried that. It's sort of a challenge, but
no, it was almost outside.
Just a window.
Yes.
A window being open.
Yeah.
Hearing your voice again, it's been such a long time, and generations at this point of people have not had a chance to listen to you sing. And the late 70s was the last record I can recall.
Yes, it was 1978. Yes.
How do you, and Colin too, for you, Shirley, how is it to hear your voice and how has it changed? And could you tell us a bit about how hard it must have been not to be able to reliably do this?
It was dreadful, and I call them my wilderness years because I could not sing. And but I had to learn to live with it and you know, find other ways of making a living. And of course, my voice has dropped a lot now because of my age, so my voice is lower. But what I do find as well is that I have to really sing, really concentrate on the singing, which, you know, when I was younger, I was sort of carefree about singing. You just open your mouth and you sing. But now I have to just focus in on it. And in a way, it sort of adds a bit of intensity, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I, voices change over the years. I think there's something extraordinary about hearing these songs through your voice, Shirley. Now it has a kind of a gravitas to it almost that, it feels somehow like you know more now what you're singing about than maybe you did in the 50s or 60s, sort of that experience you can hear in your voice.
And I'm sure that must be true, yes. But also, when this recording was proposed, I said, or when I was asked to sing occasionally, I always used to say no. But then a friend of mine pointed out, he said to me, listen, Shirley, all the music you love listening to most are the field recordings of older singers. And he said, you're one of them now. You know, just remember that you've always loved this sort of straightforwardness of it, the honesty of it, and the age of it, and what's behind that age, more ages. I mean, some of the songs, like Cruel Lincoln, for instance, probably dates back to the 15th or 14th century, and yet it's been passed on by people who've learned these songs by heart, people who couldn't necessarily read or write, but they love this stuff so much, and it just passed down through generations from people who learned it by heart, which is the way I learned it as well, directly from field recordings of older singers. So in a way, I'm quite proud to be one of those older singers now. Thank you.
So why did you stop singing? What brought on the wilderness years, asking?
It was, it was a very painful marriage breakdown. We were working at the National Theatre at the time. My husband, Ashley Hutchings, my then husband, we were working at the National Theatre doing promenade performances of a play called Lark Rise. And he just fell in love with an actress. And I mean, it's so awful because one day we were walking down the road celebrating a wedding anniversary, hand in hand, walking down our lane in Etchingham. And then the next day he came home from a visit to London and said, I'm leaving in the morning. I mean, just that abrupt. And he'd fallen in love with an actress. He'd said to me, I'm consumed with love and I'm leaving. And he left. And I tried to sort of continue working at the National Theatre because I thought, well, God, I've earned my place there. But this woman would just stand in front of me when I was trying to sing wearing his sweaters. And it was just so unbelievably awful. And it was humiliating because it was in front of the cast. It was in front of the public. And I soldiered on for a little while. And then I watched Ashley fall in love with another actress at the National. It was just... I don't know what it was. He said it was like an illness when we talked about it a bit later. And as I've said before, when you certainly had to go to bed with it. But anyway, so it just, and I had two children to bring up. And I've doing myself a disservice, I think, by still trying to sing when I couldn't. And also doing a disservice to the songs, and that's so important to me to sing them to the best of my ability. And with the best of my understanding. So I haven't lost my understanding, but I certainly did lose my ability at that time. Anyway, it's all, what's great about that is that I wouldn't be here now. I'd have possibly, I don't know what would have happened, but I wouldn't be here with an album called Lodestar, at my age, and speaking to Colin.
And Colin, you've been such a collector listening to her music for so long. And
absolutely, yeah.
Recording some of her songs. Shirley, have you heard Colin sing any of your songs before?
Well, I've seen his lovely EP with, is it your wife who drew that portrait?
Yeah, the
Colin.
Portrait of you.
Oh, it's so charming. It's so sweet. Yes, I thought she might have. Yes.
Yeah.
No, that was very flattering, except as I was thinking, he did choose songs from when I was almost too young to record. It's a funny difference between now and then. Those were such simple songs that I'd learned very early in my career. I must have been, 19 or so. But it was a huge... huge surprise, and it's just lovely because I still wasn't singing then, and I thought, well, I haven't been entirely forgotten, and so Colin, that was a lovely thing to do.
Well, I was going to say, I was thunderstruck when I discovered Shirley's music, and I didn't know at the time that she wasn't singing. You know, I didn't know what. I think I was just kind of diving into this world and assuming that it was there and always there. It was one of the only times where I think I heard one or two songs and immediately had to find everything that she'd done. And it's interesting you say that about those early songs. For whatever reason, those were the ones that I gravitated to. When I recorded them, I was 30, and I had a newborn son.
Oh.
And maybe I heard something in that kind of youthful naivete that I connected with.
Can I play something that maybe you did sing for your son, Colin? I want to play just a little bit of the opening track to the EP. Colin Molloy sings Shirley Collins.
My little laddie, dance to your daddy, my little lamb. You shall have a fish and you shall have a fin. You shall have a heron when the boat comes in. You shall have a lobster boiled in a pan. Dance to your daddy, my little lamb.
Was this something you wound up singing to your to Hank? To your
oh song? Yeah, that was a standby.
Is that right?
Lullaby.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it was. I think both Carson and I, my wife, would sing it a lot, and we ended up singing it to our second son as well. It was on the shorter side. It was always nice to find the kind of the 8-minute long ballads that you could learn because you knew that they would be asleep by the end of
well,
that.
Well, they worked then. That's beautiful, Colin.
Oh, thanks, Shirley.
Does he have any memory of it, Colin? Do you know?
Does Hank have any?
Yeah.
I think that those lullabies all kind of become collective unconsciousness. I'm sure that they fit in somewhere, you know. Some of those songs we kind of mention here and there, and he'll remember them. Of course, we have a 3-year-old now, so we're still singing them. We're not done yet. We're not off the hook. We're still learning these old songs.
And the longer, the better. Shirley, do you remember anybody singing you lullabies?
Well, I...
Or did you?
I do. I mean, I sang lullabies to my children, obviously. But I remember my grandparents singing to my sister and me during the war, when the Second World War, that is, when there were bombing raids in Hastings, where I lived at the time, when I was 4 years old or so. And we had to sleep in their shelter when there were bombing raids, and Granny and Grandad would sing to us just to, you know, to keep our spirits up and to just keep us comforted and feeling safe. As I said before, I've heard these old voices, you know, over the years, and I think in a way that's partly why I love old voices, because I still associate that feeling of security even during bombing raids when Granny and Grandad were singing to us. And they would sing lullabies, and they would sing one or two songs that I later realized were folk songs. And Granny would sing some music hall songs because she was more of a townie than Grandad, who was a real countryman. It's the security, really, and the beauty of the tunes of those nursery rhymes as well.
Did you end up recording any of those songs?
Grandad sang the Bonnie Labouring Boy, which I didn't. I recorded two verses from very early when I first met Alan Lomax. I recorded it much, much later. It was one of the last songs I sang, and it was one of the songs I was singing at the National Theatre as well in that production of Lark Rise. And it's such an emotional song for me that I think I was sort of doubly scuppered, you know, partly by the emotion that the song raised in me, and partly by this wretched actress wearing my husband's sweaters. Listen, I can laugh about it now.
Well, that's good. Now I'm angry at Ashley. I'm going to get rid of all my Albion bands.
Oh, okay. No, don't do that.
You two made beautiful music together.
Yeah. Yes, I think we did.
Is there a song off of Lodestar that that you'd like to hear and talk about?
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, I tell you what, could we play Washed Ashore? Because this is the reason I wanted to put Washed Ashore on the album was that it was the very last song that Dolly arranged for me before she died.
Your sister.
My sister Dolly, yes, you know, with whom I made so many albums. Mm. And because she had set it higher than I could even attempt to sing at that time. I wasn't able to sing it, and it was always a sort of real sorrow to me that I hadn't recorded it. So I asked Ian Keary, the producer of the album and the musical director and a very close friend of mine, if he could possibly transpose it, and he worked on it and more or less, you know, replayed Dolly's arrangement on the instrument. And it's such a tender song as well. There's a little village in Sussex high up on the Downs, and there's a Saxon church there, Friston Church. And as you walk through the gate and down the churchyard, along an old red brick path, you come to a little cross that has nothing on it as you walk towards it. But when you get past it and turn round to look at it, it says washed ashore. So there's obviously somebody, you know, washed up on the beach nearby, and the villagers gave it a proper burial and a mark there, a little cross to remember it. And it's such a tender song, and it, you know, it's my last sort of bit of Dolly as an arranger, so I'd love to hear that, please. Heartbreaking, isn't it? Yes,
it is. I mean, it's so fascinating about how the melody and the music can be so uplifting, and yet the story is so sad, so heartbreaking, and tragic.
Yes. Why does that work?
Well, I mean, I think that's something that's been done. That sort of marrying of melancholy and uplift, and it makes music more dynamic, more deeper. To enjoy it on two different levels.
That's true.
It's a counterpoint that works. And also, I think that, I mean, in the end, what is it that makes all this living worthwhile? It's the touching of hearts. It's that kiss. It's in the song. It's the that you care. You care as the as both a listener of and the empathy that you feel for the characters, but also you well could be one of those characters in some slightly different circumstance.
That's absolutely right. And I also think that in traditional song you get a sort of plainness but a beauty in the words, and then you get incredible melodies as well, you know, and the alliance of the two just fits so well. And I don't know, I just, you know, I'm just totally enthralled by this music. I can't let it go, ever. You know, just so grateful that I like it. And what I don't understand is why people can't see it or hear it, you know. They just don't get it. They think it's old-fashioned or something, but it's not. It's eternal.
It is eternal. I mean, I feel like these days, and I don't know what it is, but I'm moved more by these centuries old songs than a lot of contemporary music. It's the only kind of music that these days will actually bring me to tears. And because I think that has to do with the depth of the music. I mean, you can sit and put it on in your car and enjoy those melodies, like Shirley was saying. But that if you just take a moment, it's sort of like getting deeper into a book. If you just take a moment and really sit and listen to the entire story, all of a sudden, like, the depth of the song will just crush you, you know? And it just makes the whole experience really extraordinary, you know? There's no superficiality to these songs. There's layers of depth.
This is true. And there's no built-in obsolescence either, which there is in so much you know, modern music. And also, they're imbued, aren't they, with centuries of people's deep feelings about love and life and death, you know, and desertion and whatever. They're steeped, you know, it's just deep in it all.
Yeah, it kind of throws away the notion that you can't relate to a certain character because their experience is different than yours. Like, I feel like being moved emotionally by, a maiden in her bower, you know, being heartbroken. Like, I couldn't be more far removed from that. But there's something universal, like it's tapping into a kind of a universal feeling.
You could be a listener and hear a great keyboard part or some electronic beat, right? But for most people, they never experienced doing that, and so it's removed. Singing, however, we have all done at some point in our lives, and there's something about someone's voice who could do something that, you know, that, let's say me, who is not a singer, and I love to sing when I'm alone, but I can sing and know what it means to hear a human voice do something that I just can't, but I know it just hits all of something very special in me. That connection, that human voice connection, telling me a story directly rather than some synth or a guitar line. There's something so direct to the heart about that, those tones in a human voice telling me a story.
Though, Bob, I think you've been taught that you can't sing. I think you can't sing.
Is that the next one?
You know, and having spent a lot of time recently with Pete Seeger, his whole MO, his whole modus operandi was to get people singing. Like, he didn't care so much about his own voice. It was all about the collective voice and getting everybody singing and teaching everybody that everybody has a singing voice.
I love that. That is actually very true.
Go all on, right. Bob. Give us a song.
Put you on the spot.
Oh, boy. One thing that I've wondered in thinking of singing and so forth, and dysphonia is what the condition is that accurate description?
That's what gave its official name, because it was, you know, you might as well have a name for it, then people can sort of understand it, whereas if you try and explain the history of it, it's just too lengthy, really. And Linda Thompson suffered from this as well. Now, she and I are great friends, and I mean, a couple of times we have been on stage together at one or two things that we attended, clutching onto each other, holding each other up and thinking, can we sing, can we sing? And we tried, but, I mean, we failed. But then it didn't matter awfully because lots of other people were there as well. But as I say, Linda and I just clung to each other and thought, what are we doing here? But she's recording again now, and beautifully. And I love Linda singing, it's so from the heart as well. And of course, she's singing lots of Richard Thompson songs, which are, you know, fabulous songs.
I was wondering, during that time where you weren't recording, were you still able to sing? But just, I mean...
But I wasn't. I couldn't. Wow. I couldn't bear the sound of anything that came out of my mouth. So I didn't sing indoors. Or if I did, I stopped immediately. I started. I couldn't bear it. It just was so painful to listen to. But what I did all that time, I still kept listening to songs, mostly the field recordings, although of course other people's performances as well. And so I was still learning things all the time through, and that sort of sustained me, I think. And then there was a point eventually where I started to, I published my book, America Over the Water, in 2004, about my almost year in the States with Alan Lomax back in 1959. And once I had written that, then I thought I just want a few more people to hear this music again. And so I started to write shows called America Over the Water, in which an actor friend of mine played all the American voices and some of the English voices that were in there as well. And so that got me listening again to all the American stuff that I'd collected or helped collect, which I'd never sort of lost interest in or love for, you know, because there's such marvellous music there, you know, in America as well, as you know. And so all the time I was listening and soaking more stuff up, you know, and finally, after a great many years, there was a musician called David Tibbett of Current 93. I don't know if you know him, but he came around to me one day when I was working at a job centre in Brighton at the time, and he phoned up and said, Shirley, I really love your music. Could I come and talk to you? And he said that I burst into tears and said, oh, I thought I'd been forgotten. So anyway, he came around with a group of friends, and that was the start of a good friendship with David, and he kept asking me if I would sing, if I would like to make a little EP or something, or sing at one of his concerts. And for years I said no, I can't sing. And then I started to say, well, yes. And then when it came to the day of the concert, I would have to phone him up and say, I can't do it, David, sorry. But finally, 18 months ago, he asked me if I'd sing at a concert in London at the Union Chapel, an audience of about 600 people. And I said, yes, all right. But then I actually did it that night. Wow. It was extraordinary. And Ian was there playing accompaniments for me. And I just had to choose songs that I knew were within the range I could still singing.
What were they?
Well, it was death. Oh, yes. Absolutely seared in my memory that night. No, so I sang Death and the Lady with Ian playing slide guitar on it. Now, this is a song I'd already previously sung with Dolly all those years ago. And it was a song I just particularly loved, because I'm not obsessed with death, you know, but this song's just speak to me.
I'm going to play a little of it.
Yeah.
Thank you. death cannot you see? Lords, dukes and ladies bow down to me, and you are one of those branches three, and you, fair maid, and you, fair maid, must come with me.
When the song continues and your time has come, your time has come,
and you must away, yes. Wow. Well,
there's back with.
Yeah,
well, that's a comeback song if I ever heard one.
Yes, one or two people have asked me if I feel about death more, think about death more now that I'm old. But no, I don't really. You know, I just think about it as much as I ever did. But what this song is, I don't know if you ever saw a film. You're probably too young, both of you. Back a while, an Ingmar Bergman film called The Seventh Seal. And there's a wonderful scene in it where a knight just back from the Crusades sits on a Scandinavian seashore playing chess with death. And he's not going to win, is he? But it's a remarkable scene. And this song might even date back to the time of the Black Death in Europe, you know, when so many people were just wiped out. And it's not found very often sung by singers in the field, but, you know, there've been a couple. And it's just a marvellous sort of survival of a song as well. And it's not morbid to me, it's just really powerful, you know, and a reminder that, you know, none of us actually is immortal.
How did that feel to perform that after so many years? How did it feel to hear your voice to sing after... decades.
Well, at the concert, it was I was, you know, a bit unsteady, but there was something sort of really gratifying about it. I thought, you know, I just felt not triumphant because I'd sung it well, but just sort of triumphant that I'd managed to sing it at all, and it was just the start of you know, this, whatever you want to call this that's happening to me now, you know, is the start of this part of my life. So I was just grateful that Tibet was patient all those years and finally persuaded me to sing.
In all of the songs and stories you've collected and then retell in singing, Shirley, for someone like Colin who's heard these songs, it inspired him to write, to tell tales.
Did it, Colin?
That were original, yeah.
It did, yeah.
In all the Decemberist records that he's done.
Oh, the songs are, as well, right.
Are all these, you know, tales that you feel and oftentimes are coming from somewhere else in some past. They're almost like they're folk songs that were passed down, but they're not at all. They're a wild imagining. And I'm just wondering for you, Shirley, if you've ever felt the inspiration to write more songs rather than simply, that's really the wrong way to put it, right? to reinterpret these stories and pass them along. And for Colin, why didn't you just re-sing songs that you loved having heard Shirley? I'm just looking at these two different minds that hear the same thing and do different things with them.
Right. Well, for me, traditional folk songs say everything in song that I need to hear or sing about or be spoken about. You know, they just do everything for me. I've never felt the need to write a song. I do occasionally write melodies. I mean, for instance, I wrote the tune to Death and the Lady because the one in the book sounded just a bit banal and I wanted a deeper tune, you know, a song that had more presence, really. So I do occasionally write melodies, but I've never written words.
Wow.
I don't need to.
But
amazing. Well, it's not. Perhaps it's lazy.
No. I mean, I think there's people who interpret old songs. I mean, it's almost like they're fulfilling a duty, like they're doing something for humanity in retrieving these songs and remembering them and carrying them on and teaching them through their recording or through playing live. I mean, I think that that's enough responsibility right there for a career. You don't need to be adding to songs to it. I think just discovering them and interpreting them and then showing them to the world is important work.
Well, it's also a question for me of honoring those people in past generations who have sung those songs for us and carried them through. And I mean, in England, for instance, it was almost totally working class, the labouring class people of the countryside who kept these songs going. And they were people who in their lifetimes had been, despised and overworked and exploited and then moved out, moved on from their land once the Enclosure Act happened in England and they lost their lands. I want to honour them. They're more important to me than people in the present. I just want to sort of sing for them. To say, look, this is wonderful music, wonderful words, great art for me. I just want to, as I say, honour them. And that's sort of why I do it. Apart from the fact that I love it as well, of course,
Writing songs was the last thing on their mind at that time.
Some of the songs had to be written at the time, though, because we've got songs that date from the Napoleonic Wars here. We've got some songs that we know are 19th century songs. And yet, because they've sort of gone through that process of being passed down by, word of mouth, then they sort of acquire this sort of wonderful feel of a traditional song. But somebody had to write them in the first place, but we're never going to know who.
It does. It feels very communal. It's if we all have ownership of this music,
Yes.
As long as it's being carried on and being remembered.
Do you imagine in the future someone might sing, let's say, Valerie Plame
Valencia? It's interesting. I think it speaks to our privilege, sort of 21st century Western privileges, that everybody can write songs now and they're available, and who knows that glut of material, how much of it will actually make it through. I think it speaks to the power of these songs that they've survived. I don't expect my songs to survive so long. So when you hear these, I'm sort of in awe of them for having lasted so long. I mean, they must be doing something.
Yes, but then they were in that ideal setup. There was no radio, no television, no big music business. No internet. They just had to, sing the songs. Mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting, I think, to see whether these songs survive. The sort of onslaught of commercial music now. Mm-hmm. I think they will because I love them and because I want them to. But who knows, people are going to choose what they want to hear.
I think that the one thing, the blessing of it, we're archiving it, it's available to people. It was available to me. I feel a lot of my, discoverings, my searchings of the British folk revival of, the mid-century folk scene in Britain had so much to do with being able to kind of go around on the internet and follow little paths from different groups and so I think the people who want to find it, it will be there. There will always be a subset of people who are celebrating it. I don't see this music going away. I think this stuff is universal. I think it's a part of us,
Yes, I agree there. And you're right about, everything can be found online now. All the collections, you can just hear the recordings now, which you couldn't when I first started out singing. I had to rely on books at first before I started, hearing the field recordings and learning more that way. So this, you have to feel optimistic about it, don't you? Yes.
I think you do. I do. I feel like it. But that's my own little sheltered view.
But I also think that it comes back to something we said earlier, which is the idea that the voice is the connector here. That's what you both said the word universal. And I think that's what it comes down to. And I think that's why they're eternal. And that's why a song that's 500 years old, no matter, despite the fact that we are sitting here in three different cities across a long place talking about this music in the first place, we wouldn't care about it with all that we have in front of us and all the things we could be doing today if it didn't still resonate. And I don't see that going away.
Well, yeah, that's true. And I must say that, you know, I'm just thrilled to be here talking to you both. It's just such a pleasure for me to have a really intelligent, understanding conversation about it.
Well, your music has touched both of us so much. It certainly changed me in many ways as a teenager in the 60s and 70s.
Oh, thank you.
And then hearing this again was just a beautiful thing. So thank you so much for having the bravery to do this.
I'm so glad that you're made a record, Shirley. When I found out, I was just so excited. And it's such a gorgeous record. It's so beautiful. So well done.
Very kind. Thank you.
Thank you both so much for your time today. Very memorable conversation.
Yeah, thanks, Bob, for connecting us after all these years.
I hope we all meet in a room, maybe with the windows open and the birds singing someday.
Wouldn't that be, that would be so lovely. Listen, I can't thank you enough, Bob and Colin. It's been more than I can express how wonderful this has been. Thank you so much.
It's sweet to give back. Thank you. Take care, all.
Thank you.
Thanks,
yes.
Shirley.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
There was blood in the kitchen. There was blood in the hall. There was blood in the parlor where the lady did fall. As soon as her lord...
Colin Malloy of the Decemberists and Shirley Collins. Her new album is out now. It's her first music in 38 years. It's called Lodestar. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.
Saying the nurse shall be burned in the fire close by. Cruel Lincoln shall be hanged on the gallows side.